Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We will continue argument this morning in case number 11393, National Federation of Independent Business versus Sebelius, and case 11400, Florida versus the Department of HHS.
Last time, I promise, from American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 28th of March. Good as always to have you with us. You want to boil a day's worth of high-priced lawyering down to one sentence? Here you go.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, if the individual mandate is unconstitutional, then the rest of the act cannot stand.
That was Paul Clement this morning, the lawyer for the 26 states and the business groups that are challenging the health care law. The topic at hand today was what lawyers like to call severability. What happens to the 2,600 some odd other pages of the law if the individual mandate, that is, the requirement that most everybody in this country has to buy health insurance, is struck down? Marketplace's Gregory Warner was in the courtroom today, as he has been all week. He's with us now. Hey, Gregory.
Hey there, Kai.
How you holding up, man? Day three.
Trying. Look, I will say that at 7 this morning, the scalpers were charging $150 a ticket to get into the court.
To get in, yeah.
Although that's down from $300 yesterday.
$300?
Interest might be flagging.
All right. So if you pay your $150 today, what would you have seen?
Well, today was the question, if the court strikes down the individual mandate, how much of the rest of the law do they have to get rid of?
Right.
And as Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg put it, the question is this: should the court do a wrecking operation or a salvage job? Meaning, do they kick this back to the legislature to fix, or do they just scrap the whole thing?
And the more conservative approach would be salvage rather than throwing out everything.
So this is Justice Ginsburg, a liberal justice, asking about the conservative approach, right? Is this the conservative approach then, remodeling rather than you know, chucking the whole thing?
Well, you know, no. I mean, one of the wrecking ball arguments that conservative justices really seem to take seriously was the economic one. The individual mandate is supposed to raise billions of dollars and bring more consumers into the pool. So if the insurance industry isn't going to get that money, how can we expect them to pay for reforms like letting in more sick people? Now, the funny thing is the states apply this argument even to reforms like Medicare that have no direct connection to that money at all. They say, toss those too. And maybe the wrecking ball argument for that was expressed by Justice Scalia, in that the court can't trust Congress to remodel. It's just better to bulldoze the house and start from scratch. And here he's throwing a question to the lawyer for the states, Paul Clement.
There's such a thing as legislative inertia, isn't there?
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say, Justice Scalia, which is I think the question for this court is we all recognize there's legislative inertia. And then the question is, what's the best result in light of that reality? And
suggesting that we should take on more power to the court.
So there's Justice Sotomayor arguing for remodeling, saying, hey, we can't throw out this mandate. It's the job of voters, not judges.
So to be clear here, the question, it seems to me, before the court today was, do we declare the entire thing unconstitutional if the individual mandate falls, or do we let Congress have another whack and try to fix it, try to remodel or rehabilitate, right?
Right. And there were parts of that question. So the one question was, do they slice out just the individual mandate? And the furthest extreme of that question is, do they get rid of the whole bill?
Right.
It's well to mention that wiping out the whole bill would have enormous consequences right now, because there are already millions of people who have insurance because of this bill. And then on this question of, do you wipe out the individual mandate? You know, as we talked about yesterday, this is what we've been debating, this healthcare for all question for the last 100 years.
Right.
So now, you know, the 9 justices are going to cast their votes this week. And I don't want to make this too dramatic, but it is. They're going to spend the next 3 months deliberating. They're going to come out with their decision maybe late June, early July. And I mean, I get the sense watching these 6.5 hours of debate that the court is struggling not only with the enormous economic consequences of this decision, but actually with the political role that the court is going to take from here on out.
Gregory Warner, he's been in the Supreme Court the past 3 days talking to us about the health care reform bill and the challenges to it. Gregory, thanks a lot, man.
Thanks, Guy.
On Wall Street this Wednesday, it's going to be an uphill climb if traders want to finish in the black by Friday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Congress is once again on the brink of missing a deadline, and in doing so threatens a major federal program. The showdown this time is over how to pay for highway and mass transit projects. The law currently in force goes away. It expires on Saturday night. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports now on the many twists and turns of the federal highway bill.
If Congress misses the deadline, federal funding for highway and mass transit projects will be frozen. Joshua Shank heads the Eno Center for Transportation in Washington. He says at first, Federal Highway Administration workers would be furloughed. If the funding freeze lasted more than a week,
then states are going to start to say, look, we have to stop these projects and we can't afford to pay people, and you're going to see construction people laid off.
Shank says tens of thousands of people would lose their jobs. The Laborers International Union of North America represents about 400,000 construction workers. David Molino is the union's chief lobbyist.
You're essentially playing chicken with people's jobs and people's lives in the American economy.
The larger economy would be affected because construction companies are reluctant to buy new equipment if states are waffling on highway projects. There's one industry, though, that would benefit if Congress blows by the Saturday deadline. The feds wouldn't be able to collect the gas tax. Big oil charges the tax when it delivers crude to refineries and would normally pass the money on to Washington. John Horsley is CEO of the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials.
Every day that the program is not extended, the oil companies will get to keep their money.
And we're talking about $110 million a day. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The price of crude oil dipped today thanks to a spot of transatlantic cooperation, or at least the appearance thereof. The French energy minister raised the possibility of coordinated action to drive down global fuel prices. He said France was talking with the United States and Britain about releasing some of their strategic petroleum reserves. The White House, in turn, said, yeah, we're talking about it. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story.
The French and US presidents have something in common. Both face elections this year. Both are suffering from the high price of fuel.
French people are paying record prices at the pump. And so this has become a political issue in the campaign.
Douglas Yates is professor of political science at the American University in Paris. But he says you don't have to be a political scientist to figure out why the French president's talking about releasing reserves.
Clearly, Sarkozy is using this as a political gesture, trying to buy votes with low oil prices.
But will it keep oil prices down, even if the US, France and Britain do try to flood the market with their reserves? Kent Moores of Duquesne University in Pittsburgh thinks not.
The ability of governments to influence the price of oil products is rather limited.
And that, says analyst Nick McGregor, is because everyone knows those reserves will have to be restocked fairly soon to cope with a real crisis like Iran.
They could dent the reserves and do no more than calm the markets for a week or two.
Some analysts say the talk of releasing reserves is an attempt to scare off the speculators, to talk the market down. And for politicians facing re-election, maybe it's worth a try. Opinion polls published today suggest that in the US, as in France, high gas prices now rival unemployment as the number one economic concern. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Moving to sports now, the number of the day is $2 billion. $2 billion for a baseball team. That's the news out of Chavez Ravine. The Los Angeles Dodgers are going to be sold to a group including Magic Johnson for the aforementioned amount. Needless to say, that blows away the previous record sticker price for an American sports franchise. So we asked Marketplace's Adrian Hill to find out why a team that finished third in the National League West last year is worth so much money.
I love There's a lot to love about the LA Dodgers if you're looking to own a sports team.
There are very few iconic sports franchises in the U.S., and the Dodgers are one of them.
Neil Pilsen heads Pilsen Communications and is former president of CBS Sports.
We're talking about beachfront property, and I don't mean possible earthquake.
The opportunity to buy an icon is about as common as a perfect game. And the value of the team is much more than just tickets and jersey sales. AJ Maestas is president of Navigate Research.
What uniquely makes the Dodgers more valuable, certainly the history and the fan base, but the marketplace and the potential in Los Angeles. You know, it's the number two media market in the U.S.
That big market makes the TV rights to the Dodgers very lucrative. Maesta says broadly, TV rights can account for 30 or 40% of a team's value, in part because sports games are, as analyst Adam Swanson from SNL Kagan calls them,
DVR-proof content.
People like to watch sports live. And because you can't skip ahead while watching a game in real time,
the advertisers want live eyeballs.
If the deal is approved by the courts, those eyeballs could witness more Dodger wins. You don't spend $2 billion on a baseball team without plans for the future. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
A survey out not too long ago from the Pew Research Center found most young adults, 25 and older, living with their parents were satisfied with that arrangement. That may or may not be great for families, but for commentator Todd Buchholz, it is definitely not great for the economy.
Years ago on TV stations across the country, the late evening news began with a question. It's 11 o'clock. Do you know where your children are? I'm happy to say these days most of the little kids are home tucked into their beds. Unfortunately, a lot of the older kids, the 20-somethings, are asleep on the sofa in the basement. Call them boomerang kids or Generation Y bother, but young people today are 40% less likely to leave their home state than prior generations. In the most startling behavioral change among young people since Marlon Brando started mumbling, an increasing number don't even bother to get driver's licenses. Sure, there are great things about families sticking together. The children can set the DVR. Mom and dad can foot the cable bill. But geographic mobility creates economic mobility. Last month, I was addressing a conference in San Antonio. A Florida engineer asked me what her stay-at-home unemployed college grad should do. I asked, does he have a mortgage? No. Spouse? No. Kids? No. Joshie'd graduated just a few years ago. Then tell Joshie to grab a cheap flight to Fargo, North Dakota. The unemployment rate is 3.9%. Joshie will nab a job as soon as the captain turns off the fastened seatbelt sign. I'm not saying that our miserable job market will be cured by doling out driver's licenses, but I am worried that an aversion to risk has crept into the psyches of our young people. Perhaps it's from overprotective parents who drive their little leaguers to first base in the minivan. Or maybe it's a lingering cloud of hopelessness despite the hope and change bumper stickers. But it's not healthy. And governments make matters worse by setting up roadblocks. Almost one in four jobs requires a permit from a state agency. And most are not brain surgery. Heck, they're not even tree surgery. Say you want to move to Alabama to become a manicurist. You'll first need 750 hours of training. We need to encourage mobility among our young people, not stagnation. Sometimes the first rung of an economic ladder is hanging just above your parents' sofa bed.
Todd Buchholz was an economic advisor to the first President Bush. He is most recently the author of Rush, Why You Need and Love the Rat Race. Tell us what you think about anything you hear on the broadcast. Letters at marketplace.org. Coming up.
If you are finished scanning, please touch Finish and Pay.
What happens when robots do eat your job? Our series continues, but first, let's do the numbers. The three big exchanges all lost 0.5% today. Here's the final box score. The Dow Industrials fell another 71 points, ended at 13,126. The NASDAQ powered down 15 points, finished at 3,104. The S&P 500 took off 6 points. That's 1405 for the final tally there. The Commerce Department had some disappointing news about durable goods orders, and investors continue to worry about the weakness of foreign economies like Spain. So big international companies took the hit. Caterpillar unloaded 3.5% today. Alcoa sheared off 2.25%. United Technologies descended nearly 2% today. Bank of America deposited a gain, though, of 1.5%. Wells Fargo trotted up 1.33%. Annie's Organic Food rose 87% on its opening day of trading. Annie's is apparently known for its bunny rabbit-shaped mac and cheese. So, the company's new stock ticker symbol, you ready for this? BNNY. I know, right? You're listening to MarketWise.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, a Senate committee takes up gas prices and what we can expect in the near term. The Commerce Department reports on GDP numbers for the fourth quarter of 2011. And Fed Chair Ben Bernanke dons his professorial hat once more. His final lecture for undergrads at George Washington University looks at the economy after the financial crisis. I'm Gina Delvac.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's been a year, just a bit more, actually, since the start of the civil war in Libya that ended with the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi last October. Since then, there's been little progress in Libya in forming a government and getting the economy there back to something resembling normal. Jeff Porter's a longtime student of Libya. He runs a company now called North Africa Risk Consulting, and he is just back from a trip to Tripoli. Jeff, it's good to have you with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
So what's it like in Libya now?
It's somewhere between euphoria and tremendous anxiety. There's an overwhelming revolutionary spirit, which seems to be carrying the country forward despite a huge amount of deficiencies, ranging from traffic to identifying expiration dates on consumer products to putting in place some sort of nationalized auditing and accounting system.
Yeah. Can you say anybody's in charge? I mean, they've got this council, but is anybody really running things?
Well, there's a nominal leader, Mustafa Abdeljalil, who is the chairman of the NTC, the National Transitional Council. But the extent of his authority isn't really all that clear. Just to give you one example, I was in Libya last week, and I was hoping to visit some of the historic sites, the Roman ruins. And I was told by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs that it was unsafe for me to travel from Tripoli to Leptis Magnus, which is approximately 2 hours outside of Tripoli. So you get a sense of the limits of the control that the central government has if you can't travel 2 hours outside the capital.
Can you, if you live in one of the larger cities, can you go to the corner and buy some bread? I mean, is there a functioning consumer economy?
Oh, without a doubt. There's a lot of daylight between anarchy and chaos. And what you have in Libya is anarchy, but it's not chaos. I was able to walk about Tripoli freely. I was able to buy a cup of coffee. I bought some T-shirts to bring back home to commemorate the revolution.
That's great. That's great. They're selling revolutionary T-shirts in Libya.
Oh, tons of swag. Absolutely tons of swag.
What about big-time investment, though? Oil companies going in to get what they can, and then in return, you know, building some part of the Libyan economy back up. Is that happening at all?
Well, yes and no. The companies for whom Libyan production represented a large percentage of their global portfolio have returned to Libya. They've been sort of obligated to in order to protect their share price. The companies that can afford to hold off, where Libyan production represents an insignificant or relatively small percentage of their global portfolio, haven't gone back. They're in a holding pattern.
Yeah, but if they're waiting for stability and clarity in an environment where, I imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, there are a lot of young men running around with a lot of guns, how's that going to work out?
Well, you're kind of betwixt and between. First, there are a lot of men running around with guns. They're not out during the daytime, but they're kind of like vampires, and they do come out at night. But they behave in relatively predictable fashion. It's not willy-nilly violence. There's no terrorism, so to speak. But again, there's a big difference between predictable militias and a regularized military. Mm-hmm. So what people are looking for is the professionalization of the militias, but that's going to be a long time coming.
So here comes the internal political question. If you went to Tripoli or Benghazi or any of those cities that you've been talking about and asked people on the streets, are you better off now than you were a year ago? What's the answer?
Oh, I think people overwhelmingly would say yes. Like I said at the beginning, there's this just profound sense of euphoria. It's a real revolutionary spirit that sort of imbues everything. Just to share with you one anecdote, I was out for lunch with some functionaries from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and the waiter brought over three soup options. You had vegetable soup and Libyan soup. One of the members of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs said that he wanted Libyan soup, and then he recited sort of the motto of the revolution, which is Allahu Akbar, Libya, Maya, Maya. You know, Allahu Akbar, Libya, 100%. So ordering soup has become a revolutionary gesture.
Jeff Porter, just back from Libya. Jeff, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Time now to rejoin our traveling correspondent, David Brancaccio, somewhere in the greater American Southwest, as he continues his long, lonely coast-to-coast drive in the complete absence of human interaction. Our series is called Robots Ate My Job, What Technology is Doing to the Future of Jobs in This Country. Today, what happens when the robots do take over? Here's David again.
Mile 2100 now, trying for Las Vegas, day five. Two pieces of technology have made possible this attempt to drive across the country with only machines and no humans. Man's got to eat, so there's the self-checkout robots at supermarkets along the way. And machine number two, recognize it? I've been sneaking a $49 microwave oven into my hotel rooms, like this one in Albuquerque last night. Dorky, clumsy, effective. And for amusement, I downloaded an episode of 30 Rock. In it, Jack Donaghy, Alec Baldwin's character, tells Kenneth, the NBC page, that he's being replaced by a machine.
We're calling it Not Kenneth. We've inputted the entire page handbook into Not Kenneth's database. It knows everything you know and more.
Why, Jack? Why?
Because it's cheaper, and the argument goes the jobs robots replace are not the jobs that people really want, like retail cashier.
If you are finished scanning, please touch Finish and Pay.
Here's what I found out before I set out on my trip. A CVS pharmacy near Grand Central in New York has machines, so you can check out all by your lonesome.
Please wait.
The store also has humans on the payroll, like Lily. She says the drone checkouts have been great for the store, and customers, above all, dig shorter lines. But some do complain about the machine's attitude.
They call her the crazy lady sometimes. They said that she's very annoying.
You're totally... Please wait. System processing.
Maybe this model needs a little warmth dialed into its algorithm. While some grocery chains, including Kroger, have pulled out some self-checkout lanes, the big boy of retail, Walmart, said just the other day it's putting in more. While the company says no jobs are being eliminated, Walmart notes that every second in average checkout time saved in all its American stores is $12 million in wages it can save. And there's also the question of who wants to stand behind a register for a whole shift anyway.
Well, I don't know why people say those aren't jobs that people don't want, because I want my job. I'm fighting to keep my job.
Jackie Gitmed works as a cashier for a grocery chain out in Encino, California. She's been working as a cashier for 35 years. She says it's a good job, benefits, pension, and she likes it just fine.
My father was in the industry for 50 years, so I'm second generation. Actually, third generation. My grandmother was a cashier. So it's our chosen family profession. It sounds silly, sounds crazy, but we all like it. We are people.
But the grocery store where she works put in the self-checkout a few years ago. Workers there actually call them robots. No one got laid off, Gitmet says, but they did cut people's hours, sometimes by 10 hours a week. And now instead of just working one machine, she oversees five checkouts. She says it's exhausting to manage her lane plus four robots. But here's the important part. It's a job that works for her, whatever an economist might say about good or bad jobs.
I cannot go pick up and go somewhere else and make the same kind of money. I'd have to start at the bottom. And at 51 years old, quite frankly, no one's going to want to hire me.
Economic theory says that technological disruption shakes things up, but then the jobs get better. Machines make people more productive, and so their pay should go up and their jobs should get more fulfilling.
What you learned in economics classes is half right. It's just not the whole story.
David Otter is an economist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology who studies labor markets. He says technology does raise productivity and create more wealth. But now with innovation moving so fast, the benefits are only spreading in some directions.
And certainly the labor market has never been better for very highly educated workers in the United States. And when I say never, I mean never.
And there are many jobs toward the bottom of the workforce, janitors, housekeepers, home health aides, jobs robots don't do well. Otter calls this the hourglass economy. The big squeeze is on the middle for both blue and white-collar workers. Using TurboTax this year? Okay, so maybe one less accountant. In Pittsburgh, I saw a pharmacy robot that sorts and delivers pills.
Oh, let's see here. So, for instance, here's Sun Quan, and she needs a little bit of albuterol.
That's right. So we'll scan that, and the robot will get right to work.
It all adds up.
So automation has again, and very heavily actually, been nibbling away at those set of jobs. But interestingly, as workers are displaced from those activities, it's not necessarily clear that it's onward and upward, right? It's not the same as the movement from the farm to manufacturing.
And innovation is moving fast. There's the Google robot car that wasn't supposed to be possible. Amazingly futuristic, yes, but maybe not so amazing if you're a taxi driver. The possibility for robot jobs is almost endless.
It's absolutely correct that, this range of tasks that will turn out to be automatable or computerizable is only going to get broader.
And I was fascinated to learn even journalists are not immune.
Now, let's do the numbers.
Oh, that's pretty plausible. We could hire that guy.
That's right.
That story tomorrow. On the road, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which, notwithstanding the fact that the movie wasn't supposed to be all that great to begin with, does just kind of make you a little bit sad. The Lorax has been stolen. Police in San Diego say somebody's made off with a 300-pound, 2-foot-tall bronze statue of the Dr. Seuss figure, which, and this is the sad part, used to be at the estate where Dr. Seuss's 90-year-old widow still lives. Police say they're not sure if the theft is because of the movie or because there's just a lot of valuable metal in a 300-pound bronze statue. I go with the latter, but whatever. All right, that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media, on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow fell another 71 points. That's 0.5%. The NASDAQ powered down 15 points, also 0.5%. The S&P 500 took off 6 points. It is, 0.5%. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizzo. I hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.